We have a subject this morning that I really think we should give attention to, because it is not only arising in private lives, but is showing a tremendous influence in public affairs. Actually, the individual seems to be strongly divided between what might be termed an internal and an external code. The inner life of the average person is not consistent in many instances with his claims, his pretensions, and his affirmations. Very often, people come to seek help in various ways, and most of them have been betrayed by their own inner subjective lives. There seems to be a kind of purgatory inside of us. One of the old Rosicrucian writers pointed out that the three worlds in which man functions are all also within his own body. And if he has heaven, earth, and perdition within himself, it is obvious that it will manifest through his conduct. Now, the problem that we have with the underworld of man's inner life is the tremendous intensity behind it, an intensity that is seldom questioned or censored by the conscious mind. There are pressures against which the average person does not seem to have any defenses. These pressures may perhaps be considered as karmic. We are born into this world with a lot of unfinished business. And in most cases, we are here to pay debts, to correct mistakes, to outgrow restrictions and limitations of character. But in many instances, the mistakes are not corrected. We continue to live with them. We continue to be dominated and influenced by them. And until we are able to control the inner part of our own lives, the outer part will not function very smoothly. We will have troubles all the way along. An example of this, for instance, we can find in the educational world. The average person is considerably influenced by education. If he has received an unusually complete education, he is supposed to end as a civilized human being. But this does not seem to be guaranteed. Instead of being civilized, he is simply better trained in how to use his own selfishness and how to advance his own causes at the expense of common good. His education has not made him a basically honorable person. It has made him skillful but not good. It has made him educated but not wise. And it has left him open to most of the misfortunes of the flesh through which he will gradually pass. Now, how does it happen that 10 or 15 years of schooling do not actually change the internal integration of the person? How does it happen that we can advance so many secondary causes in our careers but not touch the basic cause of our own existence? Also, I think we have to take into consideration that most persons, regardless of their various attainments, are governed by certain atavistic pressures that have come down to them from the remote past. The flesh has within itself its own limitations. It has its own peculiar pressures. The body has demands that are completely separate from the demands of the mind and heart. The heart has demands which are not consistent with those of the body. And the mind, in its own tyranny, seeks to dominate both. This conflict within us is responsible for much of the sorrow in the world around us. Let us take another pertinent example of the situation, and that is religion. Nearly every nation of the earth has at one time or another received a valid religious message. It has been given a code, a creed, a doctrine to help the people to grow and unfold their own spiritual, moral, ethical potentials. Yet with probably 70 or 75% of the world nominally addicted to religious beliefs that are founded in the brotherhood of man, we still have one war after another. Religion does not seem to be able to control the internal selfishness of the individual. Religions have not yet even been able to make peace with each other. And a great many religions have never been able to make peace with the branches of themselves. Here is a valid doctrine based upon natural law and divine revelation, and most persons will admit that they accept it, but very few are able to put it to work in daily life. Out of the abuses of religion, there has come a general revolution producing a series of agnostic or atheistic societies. These societies insist that religion is merely an instrument used by the establishment to enslave the human mind. So they have discarded it, and they put something else in its place. And with this new thing they put in its place, they continue to enslave the human mind. There's no basic change in principles. There are new names, new political allegiances, new explanations and new justifications, but the old tyrannies go on. Now we have in the scientific world every justification for the development of a great ethical moral code. The materialistic scientist has little or no justification for his own materialism. He is constantly in the presence of wonders that should bring him to his knees in adoration of the infinite. He learns all these things without being touched by the mysterious wonder of the fields of his own researches. He is not able to actually see through his own formulas to the great principles upon which these formulas depend. And these great principles are all spiritual mysteries. So we have the scientist in the midst of the evidence of an eternal providence, doubting everything. We also have in the forms of government, there is no nation that has not received some revelation, either out of religion or philosophy, as to the proper methods of government. Most government would accept these requisites. Most governments claim justice, claim to protect and serve. Most leaders admit that they are the servants of their own peoples. But in substance and essence, these truths are not actually believed. They are held, they are accepted, they are preached, but they are not practiced. So everywhere we see a world of great needs, a world with deep and real problems, and we have all kinds of texts, religious, philosophical, scientific, ethical, political, social, even industrial, pointing out the principles that should be observed, but they are not. And the fact that they should be and that they are commonly accepted, this fact does not seem to reach into the individual deeply enough to change his basic relationships with his fellow men. Thus, we have to look inside to see why we have been able to have a Christian world for 19 centuries and yet have not been able to make Christianity the solid foundation of our mutual relationships. How it happens that we do acknowledge a religious value in life. Our cities and communities abound in churches. Many of them are very gracious and beautiful beliefs. And not a few of them are strongly supported, not only by the average parishioner, but by persons of wealth and influence. And yet these churches have not been able to prevent small towns and communities in which they stand from being locked in the most dangerous and detrimental feudalistic attitudes. How does it come that what has been generally accepted as the most civilizing force that man has ever received, how we have had this for thousands of years and for the most part have succeeded in remaining uncivilized? This goes back to the person. The answer has to lie within the individual himself. And it has to lie within enough individuals so that the ends and purposes of progress have been frustrated. Now, we know that we live it now, especially now, in a time when the private citizen is not especially qualified to make major changes in social problems. We have certain influence. We have the power of the vote. There are things we can do. But the great problems that confront us seemingly are beyond the control of the average person. He can only endure. He can only hope. And he can only give allegiance as far as possible to those principles which he regards as best. And he's not always very successful in doing this. You go and work with some of these people as individuals, and you find that many of them have studied deeply. Many of them have given a lifetime to esoteric matters. Some have become proficient in astrology. Others have gone into other phases of research, into alchemy, and into all kinds of oriental philosophies and religions. They have devoted a long period of time to the study of natural laws, as these are exemplified in the great spiritual teachings of humanity. Yet with a lifetime of such background work, with the ability to quote great authorities, with a definite allegiance to these authorities, most of the persons thus equipped are unable to handle their own affairs. They are not capable, apparently, of taking what they honestly believe and using it as it should be used. The question is why? The answer is the tremendous imposition of self-interest. As Buddha pointed out 25 centuries ago, the individual who is primarily concerned with himself is lost from the beginning. And no amount of education can help him until he gets over his own self-centeredness. Self-centeredness seems to cause the individual to cheerfully contradict his own ethics if it seems that it will produce some personal advantage for himself. Now, wherever compromise of this kind exists, its folly is based in the area in which the compromise occurs. Nearly all compromise is for the purpose of improving immediate material situations. In other words, compromise is the compromising of spiritual truths to advance material ambitions. The individual is sacrificing that which is the most valuable part of himself for the proverbial bowl of pottage. He is willing to hazard not only his present embodiment, but his health, his happiness, his home, and overshadow future embodiments with bad karma, simply because he is interested in one primary circumstance, the immediate advancement of his own purposes. This is true of nations. Nations are struggling to advance their own selfish purposes. Groups of thinkers are more concerned in trying to maintain their status as intellectuals than they are in being honest. Politicians, while they would love to be persons of high character, are afraid to stand for principles for fear they will not be reelected. And practically every educator is afraid to tell the truth for fear he will destroy his own scholastic standing. So he keeps his standing, but he falls as far as his principles are concerned. Therefore, the inside of each one of us has something in it that is as old as time, and that is the craving to do what it wants to do at all cost. This has become such a familiar part of our natures that we don't even define it anymore. We don't keep saying to ourselves, I'm catering to the worst part of my own disposition. We take it for granted that to do what we please is the primary purpose for existence. We don't defend it anymore. We couldn't. We don't try to understand it for fear that we will discover we are wrong. Therefore, we simply take it for granted that whatever impulses arise in ourselves for the advantage of our own condition immediately, these impulses are inevitable, eternal, and divinely inspired. Having taken all this for granted, we simply act over the surface of our own convictions without giving them any valid foundations. One of the most common indications of this situation is our inability to handle the golden rule. Now, there are very few people who will deny that the golden rule is important, and it has been built into the religious philosophy of practically every one of the world's religions. But the golden rule, while it can be quoted and is quoted frequently, requires an attitude toward conduct, which is generally missing. We do not do unto others as we would have them do unto us. We do unto others what we please and hope we do it so fast they can't retaliate. Also, we find that we have within ourselves a concept of love. The human heart is the holy grail of early Christian mysticism. Within it flows forever the blood of the Savior, life itself. Most persons have polished the outside of the cup rather thoroughly, but very few have examined the inside of their own emotional, spiritual attitudes. They have not cleansed the inside of their own cup, their own heart. They have used their heart to gratify whatever impulse or attitude they may happen to have. We also have in a wonderful built-in mechanism by which we convince ourselves that our own mistakes are unique and noble. We have been able to excuse and condone practically any attitude that we wish. And we always manage to do it in some way that makes us look righteous to ourselves, but not to anyone else. So we find so often that the real problem that we all face is the inability to orient ourselves in a proper definition of universal life. Now, the mystics have done probably the best of most of those who have tried. They have sought to find an internal experience of God. And wherever this experience has been legitimately found, it has been accompanied by humility, self-sacrifice, voluntary poverty, and the gradual reluctance to take part in any of the destructive patterns of human conduct. The mystic has tried to make the eternal superior to the temporal. He has thought in terms of his eternal existence rather than in the 70 years we hear about here. The mystic is the only one who has recognized a universal citizenship and has realized that the laws of the universe take precedence over any of the laws or articles which have been compiled by mankind for external purposes. The moment the laws of a nation depart from the laws of nature, that nation is in trouble, and we're in desperate trouble now. The moment the laws of integrity fail within the individual, he is in trouble, and he is in deep trouble. And, of course, the way the universe operates, there is a definite relationship between the misfortunes of society in general and the causes which have been set up by individuals within that social structure. The type of world we live in is the kind we have earned. And because we have not earned peace, we do not have it. Because we have not been thoughtful of others, they are not thoughtful of us. Because we have placed certain schemes and strategies ahead of principles and integrities, we are the victims of our own schemes and strategies, and will remain so as long as we continue in our present course. It's also very valuable to realize that our citizenship in this world is comparatively brief. This does not mean that we may not make an encore at a little later date, but it does mean that at the moment we are few of years and have many troubles. In the face of the fact that our material existence is in hazard and that there can be no reasonable doubt that we are responsible for that hazard, it would seem that in the few brief years that the individual has, that he would try to make peace with the universal plan of which he is a part. That he would gradually come to realize that he is not primarily under the allegiance of man-made statutes. He is ultimately and inevitably in servitude to a universal process, a pattern that is immutable and inevitable. To sacrifice a little of the so-called passing comforts of this world in order to assure oneself of being on the side of that which must ultimately be victorious, it would seem that in a moment of this type, we would begin to give serious thought to the correction of our own internal arrogance or misunderstanding. Now, it's for most people, it's a rather simple thing, and it isn't so spectacular, but people come to me all the time with their problems. They proceed to explain why they cannot get along with their relatives, or why they are worried to death because one of their children is planning to marry into another religion. Sometimes these people cannot orient themselves at all because of the grievances they have brought forward from the past. Individuals who claim to be emancipated from all personality will spend hundreds of hours giving the most detailed explanation of their own misfortunes. They never get over a grievance, and they seemingly have very little skill in remembering the countless good things that have happened to them. Grievances take precedence. The individual who has suffered a little has very little time left to think about the wonderful things that have happened or to realize that many wonderful things have been spoiled by his own attitudes. So he comes and seeks consolation of spirit while at the same time clinging to every prejudice that he has, determined that his own way will be supreme. He condemns all the candidates for public office, has trouble with all his acquaintances, cannot get along with his children or their children, and settles down to the point of plain suffering. Not over the problems that are real, but the problems he has created for himself. You tell this person that this is not a very good religious attitude, and after listening to these stories for hours and pointing this out to him, he will smile at you pathetically and say, "The one thing, of course, I don't hold any grudges. My problems are real, and I have been more than patient with them. I have put up with them for years and suffered for them every moment." And that person is grateful that in their own heart they love everybody. In fact, they do love almost everybody they've never met or heard of. Now, how does this happen? How can people go through an experience like this and see nothing? How can they forget what they're actually saying while they're telling it to you? How can they break the middle of a complaint to say that they never complain? The answer has to be one thing. This something inside of them has become so inevitable, so irrevocable, and so unchangeable that it is no longer even considered as a factor in anything. It is an inevitable. The individual with a difficult disposition regards this as an eternal endowment for which he cannot be blamed, which forces him to do things that he does not want to do, but he has no power not to do those things. This brings us then to the underworld problem in our own natures. For somewhere lurking inside of ourselves is this blind spot, which simply cannot permit us to work together, think together, live together, or love each other in a decent manner. Why do we have this? I've watched it and listened to it and thought about it, and it seems to me that in all probabilities, most people are born with dispositions. Being born with them, they have never known the absence of them. They have taken it for granted that their disposition is themselves, and this is not true. They have taken it for granted that their likes and dislikes arise from a divine source within themselves and are unchangeable. That if their attitudes are difficult, other people must adjust. They are incapable of modifying their own points of view. And to tell them that the point of view is wrong is simply to insult them. They will not face the fact that this thing inside of themselves is causing this point of view is something that can be changed, that can be modified, that it can be controlled. But in order to control it, the individual has to make certain changes in himself. One thing he has to do, if he wants to control this pressure, is to get over the idea or the experience that holding these negative attitudes adds to his own peace of mind or comfort. If he continues to believe that a bad disposition is the fulfillment of himself, he will continue to nurse it. As long as he is able to gain some kind of satisfaction from being difficult, he will have very little incentive to change his ways. If he finds, for instance, that through a dispositional peculiarity, he is able to revenge himself for slights or avenge some unpleasant circumstance to which he has been the victim, if he finds in it a glorification, "I told you so," and prove conclusively that some unpleasant thought was justified, if in some way or another these personal attitudes help to build his own stature in his own eyes. If they make him feel bigger, if they make him feel victorious, he will seldom decide to go against them, even though the victory that he is gaining may only be the beginning of another defeat. He just will do everything he can to defend himself. This is because his own mind is a kind of prejudiced lawyer that is going to desperately defend him, even when the lawyer himself knows that the culprit is wrong. This must cause someone or many people, especially now when the worldwide situation is so obvious, to think a minute about what these principles and problems really relate to. I think Buddhism made a very good statement of the whole thing, and it borrowed it, of course, from Hinduism. And that is the line of the Bhagavad Gita: the mind is the slayer of the real. Our problem lies in that neat little package that we call the think tank. It belongs to the mental integration. The mind is not always right. The mind is usually wrong if it is allowed to dominate. If you say to the mind, do what you want, you will have a tyrant on your hands. If you say to yourself, I will defend the mind, right or wrong, the tyrant will grow stronger. The mind which tells us to dislike each other is, in a sense of the word, an evil spirit. It is the adversary. It is the devil's advocate. The mind that justifies our being unreasonable, or tries to tell us that we can be unpleasant because others are unpleasant, is leading us astray. Because there is no possible way in which a bad disposition can be justified because of the number of people who have one. It only means that there is a larger number to be miserable. And this dispositional problem remains to the end something that stands between us and happiness. I've actually seen a bad disposition functioning on the deathbed. And among the last words of the dying person was something malicious. They never get over it. In fact, they like to assume that they're going to leave behind them something else to cause a little unhappiness to others. And when you try to find out why, you learn that other people have made them unhappy. So it must be passed on as a heritage to burden humanity for the rest of its existence. If we can get away from the idea that the mind is infallible, and also if we can get away from the pressure which the mind immediately sets up, before the other person has finished a sentence, our mind has worked up a way of refuting it. We can hardly wait to tell the other person he's wrong. Sometimes we can't wait. It can be very embarrassing on occasions, too. But if we could gradually recognize this problem, we could maybe do something about it. But to still the mind, to be able to do what it says in the scriptures, be still and know that I am God. If we can stop the mind from its multitudinous little conspiracies, if we can no longer allow it to be a yes man to our own personal desires, we can do other things and do them well. In the Orient, the answer has always been the same. Quiet the mind down. Gradually detach the mind from personal advantage. Tell the mind for once and for all that we are not primarily concerned in doing what we want to do at the moment. This is an interruption and an interference. That what we really want to do is what is best for us for all time. We are not really interested in winning an argument. What we are really interested in is living an example of integrity. Now, sometimes it takes a lot of work to get the mind to believe that. And one of the reasons it doesn't believe it is because we have failed so often to live up to a good idea. We have made a resolution and broken it before we've finished telling the name of it. It's like New Year's resolutions. Very few of them last until Washington's birthday. The individual has broken down his own defense mechanism so often that he is no longer even sure that he can keep his own promise or that he can do what he was supposed to do in the first place. The only way in which you can get the mind away from these problems is either to channel it into other directions or else learn to quiet it down. Learn to discipline it and realize that we do not use it anymore. It means that we stop abusing it or permitting it to abuse us. We have to realize that the mind is not the divine power within our own natures. The mind in us is not the God in us. The mind in us, for most persons, is an antichrist. It is working against the very purposes for which a good life should be dedicated. By slowing down the mind a little bit, or by facing it with different experiences, we gain certain help. Because the mind is capable of doing quite a lot of thinking if you give it a chance. And once you can convince the mind that it is wrong in something, it will very often go along with you. I know a number of cases in which individuals had very serious intolerances relating to religion. They were simply completely unable to accept the validity of any faith except their own. These same persons were, for the most part, racially intolerant, because races have their religions. And if you don't like the religion, you don't like the race, and vice versa. Some of these people, who were very adamant and very provincial in their attitudes, for one reason or another, moved into a foreign country. Many of them went in business capacities to the Far East. Some of them went to the African states. Others went to other parts of the world where different religious beliefs exist. It was a great experience for these people to suddenly find that they were strangers. That instead of being in control of the situation, they were isolated individuals, rather picturesque to the natives, who viewed them with the same wonder that they had been viewing the natives in turn. After a while, however, many of these people began to respect the beliefs that they had formerly completely rejected. They found that in these other countries there were sincere people, that they had beautiful thoughts, that they were raising their children well, that they had reasonable governments, that they had good educational systems, a great love of art and music and literature and all kinds of pleasant things. And many times these prejudices were very definitely corrected. But this was by direct exposure to a fact. If they had not gone there of themselves, they would never have accepted. This also carries with it the possibility of changing the minds by exploring and investigating those areas in which you hold prejudice. There's a very cute story of an old English theologian who loved to write sermons and give them with great passion against astrology. Well, of course, in that day, as in now, the astrologers were a kind of minority group that were not flourishing too well. But finally, he ran out of information. He couldn't figure out anything more to say to deride the subject. So it occurred to him that the only possible answer was to make a few acquaintances among the astrologers themselves so that he could find out new weapons against them. So he went and cultivated several astrologers for a short time and then came back and never discussed the subject again. He admitted that the more he knew about it, the more he realized his own prejudices and opinions. So often, by mingling with something against which you have a prejudice, you will make an important discovery. But only if you will use every possible internal resource to prevent the prejudice from anticipating the changes and leaving you without a clear mind to do your own thinking. Another possibility in this type of thing is simply to reduce the areas of unfair prejudices through a little philosophy. Now, philosophy has a place in religion. Some people think it's a separate subject, but it really isn't. Philosophy is a kind of way of bringing yourself into harmony with facts or helping you to understand or evaluate the situations that arise in your personal thinking. So a little philosophy can be very valuable, and it can help you to recover from this feeling of the immense urgency of having your own way. Philosophy can begin to tell you that most of the situations in which you are unpleasant or unkind have very little substance in themselves. You are very anxious to get ahead. You are going to sacrifice friendship, family, integrity, and everything in terms of wealth. And about that time, you read in the paper about the individual who got his first million and the next day had a coronary. Thinking this over, you can do a little philosophizing. Are the things you are reaching for worth the dangers that they bring into your own life? Now, one of the common things that brings danger into our own lives is not necessarily an inveterate ambition. It is an inveterate irritability. Many people simply born in the objective case. They never are able to agree with anything. They find fault with everything. They criticize and condemn whether they know anything about the subject or not.
And, of course, always feel that they are well informed, simply because that is the way they feel about it. Now, if a person goes through life constantly belittling others, or constantly trying to press some advantage to themselves, or sitting in judgment on other human beings,